Okay, so how to talk about GA, how to introduce GA. Every time you do it a little bit differently. And I think that's kind of the nature of GA and the originary hypothesis. I'm going to try it this way, right? To think about what's a starting point for thinking about things in general, right? We have certain instances of this and say the history of thought and the history of philosophy in particular, right? You can go back to Socrates and Socrates, one way Socrates began his inquiries, his questionings of Athenian citizens was with the question of just what do words mean, right? What does the word good mean? When you use the word good, what do you mean? How do you tell what's good from what's not good? And then you just sort of start talking about that, and this starts to reveal all these kinds of assumptions and confusions and things that you knew without realizing that you knew them and didn't know and thought you knew and so on. In modern philosophy, we have Descartes, who in a sense does something similar, tries to reduce things to the most basic. What can I know that I know that I'm not being deceived about, right? So, I think therefore I am. The very fact that I'm thinking, even if I'm deceived in all my thinking, at least I know that I'm thinking. So, that's we could try a similar way, but the way I would start with GA is the question of how do we know that I mean that we're talking to each other? How do we understand each other? I mean, how is it possible that I stand next to someone and I talk, and that person, one way or another, even if that person doesn't understand anything I'm saying, at the very least, that person knows that I'm using words, that I'm saying something that potentially could be understood, right? And they could say something to try and minimize the difficulty in understanding it. So instead of starting even with the meaning of particular words, we can begin with, how is it that we're even able to do that? How are we able to even kind of know that we should be understanding each other in the first place, right? How do we even, animals, this is something animals don't do, right? Animals can kind of be, try and figure each other out and can kind of confront each other and can follow each other and all this kind of thing. But, animals don't, listen to another animal, what's going on here, and try and figure out what the other is saying. So this basic assumption that we're here to kind of understand each other needs to be explained, right? And every time that we try and understand each other, it's kind of happening over again, right? In a certain sense, it's a new thing that's happening. It's always an event of understanding that we're engaging with, right? So in a sense, GA starts with understanding through an event, right? And it starts with, well, okay, what are we understanding each other instead of doing, right? Every time that we understand each other, well, we're involved in some kind of situation where we want something similar, or we're trying to do something together, or whatever it might be, and in such a situation, well, it can kind of break down, right? And in the sense here, we can draw upon modern social sciences, which got which have always been very interested in how things can break down, how things get put together, right? We can try and answer that question. How do they break down? Well, people want the goods or the things that are produced by a social order, and they don't find a way to share it or distribute it or to have access to it in a way that everyone agrees on, and some way or another this has to be settled, even in a way that's not satisfied, that doesn't satisfy anyone or everyone, but at least in a way that there are enough people who prefer to accept the peaceful solution compared to whatever the non-peaceful solution might be, right? And that can be a question of superior force, but then again, how is the superior force organized? You need to get a lot of people agreeing on a particular solution in order to organize them into a force that would be strong enough to deter the others. So we start with these, you know, these basic kind of, you know, social problems, social issues. How do people, you know, how people were able to, are able to kind of organize ourselves in this way. And, you know, again, you can try and find, you know, certain laws and certain regularities and so on. And GA's approach is again, to go back to, you know, the most basic event in which people would have, first of all, done something like understand each other, right? Well, what would that be? So it's an event, right? It's a situation, right? Let's say it's a situation where everything is about to break down. Well, what could cause everything to be on the verge of breaking down? Well, everybody's kind of rushing towards something. Everybody wants something. Everybody's kind of misunderstanding each other. Everyone's ready to fight with each other and so on. Well, why is something like that going to happen? Well, you know, in an animal community or group, you know, these things get settled in advance. There's a pecking order, right? The, you know, the one wolf or one one, you know, bear or whatever, you know, whatever animals we're talking about, you know, an ape is kind of the strongest one. And anyone who wants to kind of take him on, you know, fights him, and whoever fights, well, that's then the alpha animal, right? So that kind of order doesn't really work so much among humans. I mean, you know, we get kind of simulations of that sometimes among humans, but that, you know, that really couldn't hold, you know, any kind of social order together. So that must have broken down. Well, so how would that have broken down? Well, what kind of, you know, beings are we talking about? Well, if we're talking about apes and we're talking about advanced hominids, right, where, you know, we're accepting something like, you know, a theory of evolution for now, that human beings emerged, evolved out of a species that wasn't quite human, right? It was pre-human, it was proto-human, whatever we want to call it. Well, this would be a more, you know, a relatively intelligent species. And what exactly is, you know, amount, what really counts as intelligence? Well, intelligence is more than anything else, you know, kind of mimetic ability, right? The better you're able to imitate, you know, the more things, the more intelligent you really are, right? And the more you're able to kind of, you know, assimilate, you know, the practices and the observations and so on of others and kind of transform them into something that could be imitated in turn. Well, I mean, that's really what, you know, counts as intelligence. So we have, you know, so we have these very mimetic beings, and if they're mimetic, then they become more and more like each other, right? Imitation turns people to be more and more, turns anything, you know, any being into being more like, you know, their, you know, colleagues, co-species, co-specifics. And so we imagine a situation in which mimesis would have driven these kind of proto-human, highly intelligent animals into a kind of crisis where the pecking order doesn't work anymore. Okay. And so they all are going for one thing. They're all heading for one thing, trying to, you know, to grab something that they all want, and they all want all the more because all of the others want it. And something would have to happen there to make them, to stop them from all killing each other, or, you know, maybe starting a fight and then breaking off, and then they just end up where they were. We wouldn't get any kind of transformation out of that. The only thing that would get some kind of transformation is something that stopped them. And the thing that stopped them would also have to be a kind of imitation, right? I mean, we're not really stepping outside of imitation. If I'm heading for something and you're heading for something, and I kind of, you know, see you and you see me, and I kind of put out my hand, and that shows that I see that you're kind of heading towards something, and we're likely to collide if we keep heading towards it. And if you do the same thing, right, if you don't do the same thing, if you keep heading for the object or kill me or whatever, well, then, yeah, the scene ends and nothing new really happens. But if you imitate me in that new way and put out your hand as well, well, then we have something new. And this is something that we can call a sign. We can even call this a word, right? Now, putting up your hand means I'm not going to go after that object. And if you put up your hand, that means that you agree that you're also not going to go after that object, right? So, how this is going to work in a specific situation, well, we kind of have to, you know, invent new ways of showing each other this. But you can say that pretty much everything that we're doing with each other in one way or another is showing each other, signing to each other, demonstrating to each other that, you know, there's a space here open for doing something other than colliding, right? Well, what that might be, well, we don't know. That's why understanding can be difficult, right? But the very possibility of understanding, that we know that we're supposed to be understanding each other, well, something like this is how that would be possible. And so what GA does is now it tries to understand all human interactions, all human groups, all human practices, societies, rituals, all of this, in terms of all the ways in which human beings have invented showing each other that, you know, we prefer to open a space where we don't collide than to just pursue, you know, what might seem to be, you know, the most obvious approach, which is to kind of take things, you know, to take something that's available before the other one does it, or get rid of the other one, and so on. And these possibilities are always kind of in the background, right? And all, every, you know, moral code, ethical code, and so on is always taken into account the possibility that, you know, that could happen. So we build in, you know, these kind of ways out of this impasse, right? It's kind of impasse, and everything intelligent that human beings do and everything inventive that human beings do is finding ways out of this impasse. Now, one more thing I'd say, which kind of gets at this from a different angle, is, I mean, it seems to me, you know, GA might sound very complicated, but I think part of what might make it seem complicated and difficult is that it doesn't really fit into existing disciplines. And everything that we kind of know about the world, we know through, you know, various disciplines, whether it's through sociology or through economics or kind of literature or whatever. And GA kind of, you know, transcends all of those, right? As you know, anyone who's been in the academy, you know, at any time over the past few decades knows that people talk about interdisciplinarity and even transdisciplinarity, but GA is genuinely transdisciplinary, right? It's kind of outside of all of these disciplines. And so it's difficult to see what GA is doing and what GA is saying, even though in a certain sense it's very simple, right? We, you know, mimesis leads to violence. We defer the violence that mimesis leads us to by putting forward signs, gestures, anything that means something, because what means something is what prevents us from pursuing that mimetic violence till the end. Okay, so now this you can, you know, you can use to situate any kind of human, you know, human encounter, right, or any human endeavor, right? But the difficulty again is that it's outside of all these disciplines, and it's kind of, you know, it might help to, you know, situate GA in, you know, in a sense you can say there's almost a kind of, you know, not so much a counter history, but a sort of parallel history of transdisciplinary modes of thought, right? If you look at the history of kind of institutionalized thought, so to speak, over the 20th century, you see, you know, the establishment of disciplines everywhere. All these disciplines that we're so familiar with now, sociology, psychology, economics, I mean, they all really got institutionalized in the modern university, beginning, you know, late 19th century, early 20th century. Now, alongside of that, you kept having these kind of transdisciplinary modes of thought that emerged alongside it, right? You had, you know, Marxism was something like that. Marxism claimed to account for all of human endeavor across all of the disciplines, right? So Marxism would talk about, you know, not only economics, but politics and literature and culture and religion and all those other things as well. And psychoanalysis was another similar kind of transdisciplinary endeavor. And you know, Freud also wanted to be able to claim to talk about art and religion and politics and civilization and all of these other things as well. He didn't see it as kind of a narrow, you know, to be kind of plugged into a psychology department, right? And you know, and that continues. And you have, you know, semiotics is also something like that, and structuralism is something like that, and cybernetics is something like that. And I'd say that on a kind of more popular level, right? If you look at a lot of things that are called, you know, that are kind of called conspiracy theories, and if you look at a lot of things that you know, that are considered to be sort of, you know, crackpot theories and so on, that in a sense, they're also trying to continue this sort of transdisciplinary impulse, because there's, you know, there's a realization that the disciplines, you know, really can't contain knowledge, right? That you can't, you know, fracture knowledge, and you can't break it up. you can't draw a sort of firm boundary between psychology and sociology and sociology and linguistics and so on. So this impulse to keep, transcending that into these transdisciplinary modes of thinking is going to keep, is going to keep emerging. And, I think that the way in which they then get sort of domesticated, right? Because then you have kind of a Marxist literary criticism, and you have a Marxist psychology, and you have a psychoanalytic literary criticism, and you have a psychoanalytic, theory of religion. And so they all get domesticated into the different disciplines, except for the crackpot theories, which no one wants to touch. I would like to think of GA as kind of occupying all of those spaces, right? As a kind of new, a successor on the one hand to things like Marxism, psychoanalysis, cybernetics, and so on, and kind of tapping into this possibility of really talking about anything, right? Just kind of a total human science that's really about everything human. And at the same time, I think it has a kind of, a popularizable sort of underground character as well, that kind of raises questions that no one else is willing to raise, and in particular questions of mimesis and conflict and crisis, which people really, it's very difficult to acknowledge. Yeah, everything that I do is mimetic, right? And I see, Girard is kind of, Girard is also in this kind of transdisciplinary tradition, and so Gans is part of that. And I see, I see mimetic theory is getting a lot of representation now, and I see it on Twitter, and I see it on the internet, and so on. Even if it hasn't made such a big impact in the disciplines, there's a little cultural and literary criticism that's Girardian at this point, but Girard hasn't really been assimilated into the disciplines as well either. So in a sense, there's something good about that. Maybe if there's something about this way of thinking that's resistant to being disciplined and being kind of broken up and broken and kind of segmented in this way, maybe that's what makes it interesting. Maybe that's what makes it possible to use it to engage in all kinds of questions, especially now everything's coming into question, right? There's the, there's nothing, we inherited from, I'd say from the Cold War, a very kind of, rigid set of, parameters for thinking about politics and ethics and morality, with concepts like freedom versus totalitarianism and socialism and capitalism. And anyone who's kind of looking around today can see that all this is really crumbling, right? And that these positions really, anyone who kind of takes these positions is right away seen as just mimetic, right? Is just trying to hold on to, even some source of funding in a lot of cases, but certainly some identity that was formed under conditions that, that person doesn't even understand, because it was formed through, through these kind of media campaigns and through, through think tanks and through universities and so on that set up the discourse, and ultimately even, national security agencies, which set up these discourses. And now all of this is becoming visible, right? So in a sense, we have a situation where this kind of disclosure and things that, just about everyone took for granted, except a few crackpots here and there. Now is all open up for questioning. It seems to me that that GA is going to be part of this questioning, and it's going to be a very good, way of pursuing this kinds of questioning, because you could talk about anything that humans do under any conditions in these terms. And there's no, there's the work of Eric Gans, and there's the work of some of Gans's collaborators and colleagues, and there's my work, which follows in Gans and does things a bit differently, but everything is wide open, and there's a possibility for taking GA and someone ambitious and someone wants to just go back to the beginning and think about the originary hypothesis and follow through an analysis of institutions, based on that. Maybe you'll go way off course, but you'll notice all kinds of things that you didn't notice otherwise, and you'll start new conversations. So I would position GA in the middle of all of this kind of maelstrom that's emerging right now, and ultimately is a way of kind of deferring certain kinds of violence and providing a way forward.